Good morning. We'll call the meeting today of the Ag Policy Committee to order. We do have a quorum. And Representative Lewitt, did you check the minutes of the meeting, and would you so approve them?
Mr. Chair, I'd move the minutes as presented.
Minutes for the March 7th meeting. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion passes. Minutes are approved. Thank you. Busy day-to-day audit committee is meeting, and because of that, trying to get people in here when they can, because of scheduling with other committees, we're going to hear Representative Torkelson's bill first this morning. If it deals with buffers, a favorite topic in greater Minnesota. And Representative Torkelson was just here. Yeah, there he is. We're going to call down House File 1994, bill that deals with buffers. And good morning, Representative.
Morning.
I will introduce your bill, House File 1994. And go ahead and present your bill, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was up there practicing to be a lobbyist, and it wasn't working out very well, so they actually kicked me out.
Is this one? Representative Mendez. Okay.
I'm sorry. I didn't know I was going to be first, but I'm happy to be first. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. This bill is another clarification of the ongoing effort to make the buffer program workable.
And do you have an amendment? No?
Yeah, I think I do.
Okay. There's an A1 amendment here.
I'd like to, Mr. Chair, if you'd be so kind as to move the A1.
I would move the A1 amendment. Discussion to the amendment. The A1 should be in your packets.
The A1 amendment brings the bill into the same shape as it passed out of the Environment Committee as it went to taxes. The difference was that the bill that went to taxes had the funding piece attached to it. This bill does not have the funding piece, but the A1 amendment puts the rest of the bill in the same shape as it came out of the Environment.
Very good questions from members. Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a question about lines 1.22 to 1.24 of the amendment. So I just, when it talks about public waters and what that actually means, I'm just wondering, I know that you're saying this is a clarification bill to the buffer law, but it seems like it's an alteration bill to the buffer law. And so I'm just, I was very supportive last year when we came forward and had the clarification bill and trying to make sure it was better understood amongst farmers, landowners, soil and water conservation districts, everybody who was engaged in this. This appears to actually make some changes, and on this particular part, I'm just wondering what exactly does this mean when you're making this change?
Chair, well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative. The change here really is to clarify that the inventory we're working with is the public waters inventory that was agreed to for the most part back in the 70s, early 80s. And not the public waters as they're described other places in statute.
Representative Poppy?
And Mr. Chair, thank you. And what, in essence, what does this do to the buffer law as it currently exists as far as the numbers of acres or miles of shoreland that's impacted by that?
Chair Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. So you're asking about other parts of the bill now?
Yes, I probably shouldn't leave from this since we're on the amendment. So, right.
Well, I'd be happy to answer your question, okay. Representative. There is no this bill does not change the number of miles that are affected by the buffer law. The change is that it classifies things a little bit differently to make it clear what's expected by the state under certain circumstances on the ground.
Follow-up, Representative?
Thank you. And then if he could just clarify on lines 2.1, thank you, Mr. Chair, 2.1 to 2.4, what exactly that is doing as well.
Chair Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Earlier in the bill itself, we deal with the APO authority. APO authority is Bowser's penalty authority. In the original bill, we had decided that it was a good idea to offer a limited APO authority to counties that take jurisdiction. That authority was limited to $500, not clear exactly how it was to be applied. I have found but there, I know of no counties that are interested in utilizing that APO authority. But what's happened is landowners and operators have looked at that in the bill and thought, oh, this is the only penalty, mm-hmm. and that if I pay $500, I'll be able to skate free. That is not the case. It's just one tool that counties could use if they chose to, and I found that there are no counties that are interested in choosing that option. So this eliminates as an option for counties, mostly to make sure that landowners and operators understand that that this APO penalty is not how this is going to be operated by a county. Counties have their own tools available through ordinance to work with landowners and, if necessary, apply enforcement measures to those landowners.
Are we okay?
I'm okay with the amendment so far.
So with those clarifications, all in favor of adopting the A1 amendment, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
No.
The amendment is adopted. Chair Torkelson, then to your bill 1994 as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll just kind of highlight the clarifications that are in the bill. We've already talked about the first thing, and that is the change in the APO authority, and I think I've described that quite thoroughly. I won't spend any more time on that. The second change in the bill deals with the soil loss ordinance. This is an ongoing discussion about how soil loss ordinance is to be applied. And the change in the bill would require counties to adopt the soil loss ordinance rather than it being applied in a statewide fashion. And I believe that's appropriate. We've also already talked about the change in the public water section of the bill. That was part of the amendment, and so I don't think I need to cover that again. The next, in section 4 of the bill, as you know, this buffer requirement applies to public ditches and to waters on the public waters inventory. The most common complaint I've heard from landowners and operators is that I had this ditch on my property that's been there for decades. I've always thought of it as a private ditch, but when the public waters inventory map was produced by DNR, it's been revealed to me that this is part of the public waters inventory. In most cases, these look like a ditch. They've been constructed like a ditch. They've been maintained like a ditch, but yet because it's on the inventory and not on the public ditch system, it requires a 50-foot buffer, whereas his neighbor's ditch across the section is on the public ditch inventory, only requires a 16.5-foot buffer. So this is an effort to divide the public waters inventory into two baskets. One basket would include those waters, public waters that have a shoreline classification. That would be, in my mind anyway, your typical rivers and streams that have a natural look to them, where water can run over land and into the water. And the other basket would be those public waters that do not have a shoreline classification and look and act and are maintained like a ditch. Now, I realize it doesn't come out quite that clearly once you get out there in the real world. There's going to be questions. There's going to be discrepancies. But if a county takes jurisdiction, I've been told, and I believe it's true, that the counties can actually designate which waters are designated with a shoreline classification and which ones are not. They can sort this out on a county-level basis, do it in a fair way that not only protects our waters but also treats landowners more fairly. And I'm trying to send a message from the state, from the legislature, that that is what we expect the county to do.
I would agree, Chair Torkelson. That's the biggest concern I've heard as well. Well, among others, but I've also seen instances where it shows up on the public waters inventory, but over the years it's been tiled and there is no evidence of a water course. Is it your hope that the counties could deal with situations like that as well?
Right, and I think you might want to talk to DNR to get their perspective on this, but DNR has been dealing with those on a case-by-case basis. I know they've been removing at least some of those from the inventory as they update the information and understand what's actually been happening on the ground. There's never been any intention, in my mind anyway, that we put a buffer on something that's already been put in a tile and has been filled in and we're farming over it.
Question from Representative Bly.
Thank you, Chair. Actually, you were just addressing what my question was going to be, and I think you're right that the DNR can come and talk about it. But from my understanding, that they've been working through the list of questions or concerns people have. And I guess my thought is I wonder if it's really necessary to get in the middle of that. I mean, it seems to be working pretty well where they're able to visit with people and identify whether or not, what you're calling the private ditches and maybe on record as a public body of water, they can sort that out. I mean, it seems like it's working pretty well as people get to the questions. And I'm sure there will be questions coming forward as people get letters and all that, too.
Chair Corpelson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Bly. You're probably right to a degree that certainly DNR has been working to update the maps. And with the availability of alternative practices, in many cases, there will not be a 50-foot buffer required. But I think it's really important that we as a legislature and as a state government send a message to landowners that we don't expect you, if your ditch happens to be on the public waters inventory and not on the public ditch system, that we, for some reason, expect you to have a 50-foot buffer, whereas your neighbor across the road on the public ditch system is only required to have that 16.5-foot buffer. I know that there's variances and complications because this is complicated work, and the landscape varies dramatically from county to county and area to area in the state, and that's why I'm really trying to create a situation where county boards and watershed districts will want to take on this jurisdiction, because I believe it's at that local level where we can get these things properly sorted out. The effect of this would be to make the public waters inventory actually more meaningful, because then we'd have shoreline designations for a reason and non-shoreline for a reason.
Okay. Continue on.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. The next change in the bill actually removes the November 1st deadline. That would then make the 17 deadline, and that would make the deadline for everything November 1st of 2018. I believe this is appropriate because there have been so many uncertainties up to this point. Number one, when the governor pocket vetoed last year's tax bill, he eliminated the available funding for counties that take jurisdiction. So counties have been reluctant to make a decision until they know whether or not help is coming from the state to fund a mandate to do the buffer program. There's still some confusion about guidance from Bowser. They haven't got all those documents completely vetted yet. I just think it's unreasonable to expect people to make decisions until they have all the information in hand. This still, on the other hand, stays within the governor's original time frame to get this work done by November 1st of 2018. The next section of the bill deals with the availability of cost share money, and I want to make it clear that this is cost share money for the installation of buffers. It's not meant to be cost share money to cover the cost of the land itself, but to cover the costs of preparing the land and planting a buffer. And the language says, in this case, that unless that cost share has been offered to the landowner or operator, they are not subject to the buffer requirement. And finally, I'm removing the date for counties to accept jurisdiction. The director of Bowser has said many times publicly that there is no effective deadline for counties that they can adopt opt-in or opt-out of jurisdiction on a date of their own choosing. And again, because of last year's tax bill being vetoed, counties have not been able to make their jurisdiction decision because they don't know either if funding is going to be available to help with the implementation of this buffer law. That covers the waterfront, Mr. Chair. I'd be happy to take more questions.
Well, I like the changes you've made, the date being pushed back. And there's also precedence for if the funding is not available to implement the buffer. We've had that with some livestock, manure management type programs as well. So if the funding is there to help pay for that, or in this case pay all of it, that would establish the need to get it done. So questions from Representative Johnson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I sit in the Environmental Committee, and we heard the other bill. And the other bill had a part that was really, I thought, pretty important, the funding mechanism to the local SWCDs. And I guess I'm just curious about, you know, why this bill or what happens to that funding mechanism. That, you know, that's the measure that really needed to get done last year, as we all know, that we need to do it now. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that, Representative Torkelson.
Chair Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Where's that mute button? Ms. Representative Johnson, that bill is alive and well and headed for the Tax Committee. It's certainly my intention that we facilitate that. Because we happen to have two bills available, the policy bill and then the combination bill, it just seemed to make good sense that we bring the policy bill to a policy committee. I'm full support of the funding side of this and expect it to happen.
Yeah, this part of the bill is what I wanted to hear in this committee, the policy aspects of it, the funding that is up to others. So that's why we are hearing the 1994 bill here as well. We have some testifiers. If there are no more questions from members, Bowser and DNR, if you want to come down together and give your testimony. Then we have Mark Tenike and Trevor Russell on deck. Good morning. Identify yourselves and proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. Angie Becker-Kadelka, Assistant Director with the Board of Water and Soil Resources.
And Mr. Chair and members, I'm Sarah Stroman, Assistant Commissioner with the Department of Natural Resources.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you for the opportunity to provide brief testimony on House File 1994. We appreciate Representative Torkelson's work on this topic over the past couple of years and know that buffers has been a topic among many committees. In the last several months, Bowser has attended well over 30 meetings around the state, and local soil and water conservation districts have been proactive in their outreach for how to implement the buffer law. Events like Wilkin County's SWCD's Burgers and Buffers to walk into fields with landowners, soil and water conservation districts have been implementing the buffer law, and the results are showing good progress. And while this bill doesn't include the riparian aid piece that Representative Torkelson mentioned, it's also supported by the governor and will enable compliance and enforcement of this law to be administered locally, which has been the intention of the law all along. We wanted to share briefly our review of this proposal, proposed language. So first, removing the APO penalty takes away an option from counties. Leaving it in does not require them to accept APO or that administrative penalty order. It just simply provides another option. We have been approached, Bowser has been approached by two counties who are interested in this option and learning more about it, seeing if it fits for them. This language then would take away that ability for them to have that option. In Section 5, Subdivision 7, that is the proposed language of corrective action that would require 100% cost share. That would add an unknown fiscal commitment and potentially decrease the effectiveness of this law. In Section 2, Subdivision 1, the soil loss guidance, now the proposed language reads that it would only apply to counties that adopt a soil loss ordinance, which changes previous legislation and may impact mechanisms of citizens who would then be interested in soil loss and as it impacts them, their abilities to move forward with their issues at the county level that have not adopted an ordinance. We believe that the date issue is already addressed in the current law. So the date issue right now, if a landowner applies for any sort of financial assistance at a state level or at a federal level, they automatically get a waiver that takes them to November 1st of 2018. So that's in current law. And we feel that current law then covers that, and this is for public waters, that covers that until the 2018 deadline that is also on public ditches. So finally, we've been working very closely and cooperatively with other agencies, with counties, with watershed districts, and with soil and water conservation districts in the implementation of this law. And we look forward to the continued work to make this happen. The forward progress has been great, as they've been doing their inventories and work. These are the right people to be doing this work on the ground locally where it's happening. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions from members? Representative Lewin.
I'm curious why we would have to get a waiver then if you started out the conversation on dates that it's all taken care of by the existing language. I would suggest that the people out there have enough to do without having to come back and formally request a waiver by simply getting rid of that 2017 date. That just takes one more load off of the people out there trying to do this.
Amen.
Mr. Chair, members, I'm sorry, I wasn't sure if there was a question.
Repeat it again, Representative.
Very specifically, why are you going to require the folks out there to get a waiver to push this out one more year? You started the conversation out about the dates as if basically no big deal. But then you said a waiver. That requires an application. That requires people to meet. That requires people to wait until they find out where we got the waiver. Frankly, that's not helpful.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you for that comment, and thank you for explaining further. So right now, the date of November 1, 2017, we believe, as working with soil and water conservation districts and their work on the implementation, that this is possible, it's doable. The amount of preliminary compliance right now that the soil and water conservation districts have done has been really high. There's each county, some counties are reporting well over 99% compliance already. Other counties, you know, in the 80s or some that are in the 50s and 60s. So we believe that date is, for public waters, is works and doable. And if a landowner decides that date, if they've decided by that time that they want to apply for financial assistance, so if they're in applying for financial assistance for something else, state cost share, something else, that simply gives them the mechanism to say if there's maybe money not available, if they're going through that application that's separate from the buffer wall. So if they want financial assistance, that automatically gives them the one-year extension. And so that's the difference, is if they would be going in for the application for something else, it wouldn't be for the buffer wall. It would be if they want cost share, if they want financial assistance. So that would be what they would be going in for, and that would get them the waiver of the year.
Follow-up question.
Well, I like the word automatically get the waiver, but I'm not sure how we automatically get the waiver. This is an additional burden, and it's going to hinder the project. And I realize there's a lot of great things going on out there, but we're focused on the folks that are not on the other side of the ledger. And so, again, somebody's got to stick up for that 1%.
Okay. Comment or just move on? Okay. Oh, question from Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my questions relate to the alternative practices, which is an opportunity where buffers don't make sense. And I said over the last couple of years that, there's many places that we know where a buffer doesn't make sense, and we don't need to describe those, but I think that's well acknowledged, and the law provides for alternative practices. I know that there's the list, and the law refers to the NRCS Field Office Technical Guide, and the list is fairly extensive in there as regards potential alternatives. But when I talk with farmers, they're actually trying to implement this law. They're working at it, and they want to do it right. And that doesn't surprise me, because that's the way they farm. And so they look at that list, and they go, well, would that be the right practice, or would this be applicable? They have questions about that. And so I say, well, I encourage them to talk to the SWCD office and, on and so forth. So my question for you is then, is there capacity out there to help those farms, kind of farm by farm? I think this, when we're talking alternative practices, I think there's value in going farm by farm. And it could really yield some good benefits for water quality and make this law make better sense to farmers. Is there a capacity? Could you comment about what that response is and can be for farmers who want to do it right, who need that help to determine the alternative practice?
Ms. Fidel, go ahead.
Mr. Chair and members, Yes, the short answer is yes. The Soil and Water Conservation District, that is exactly the role that they have that's out there. And what we've been hearing is that that's what they've been doing, is they've been going out there, they've been working with landowners, they've been working with farmers to find out what are the best fits for their land. Soil and Water Conservation Districts have the authority to work with landowners to determine if the landowner feels like a buffer is not the right fit for their land, the way it flows, the way it's shaped, the way the land works for them, then the Soil and Water District has the authority to go out and work with them on alternative practices that can be used to meet their needs.
Follow-up, Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then my follow-up on this is, one is related to the timeline. Is there enough time for these decisions to be made? Because, as you know, farmers are making decisions right now. And then also, is there some kind of a mechanism where their choice can be validated somehow? Because I think there's some fear. I've heard farmers say, well, I fear that if I put this in, it won't work, and they want it validated. They're going to make an investment in that alternative practice, and I think, you know, it's fair that they need to know that that will work for them.
Ms. Cadell?
Mr. Chair and members, yes, and in fact, the current law provides for a validation of compliance where if a landowner comes in and you know, as you say, that what we've seen and what the Soil and Water Districts have been reporting to us is that really the vast, vast majority of farmers, as we all know, want to do the right thing. And that's been proven over and over again over the years and is certainly the same that they've been seeing here too. So if they come in and ask for a validation of compliance, they don't have to, it's not required, they don't need one. If they come in and ask for one, then the Soil and Water Conservation District can look at their land and can issue them a validation so that they have a piece of paper that says, you know, as of this date, this land is deemed compliant for the buffer law.
Thank you. Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms.
Becker-Kadelka.
You were right. Thank you. I heard two different names there. I thought which would explain the way. Ms. Becker-Kadelka?
Mm-hmm.
I apologize for that. I want to go back to the deadlines that Representative Lewick talked about. I do support what Representative Torkelson is proposing. I'm very concerned that even 2018 is a deadline. If I had my choices, we'd push the entire dates back. And I'm really concerned that when you say the SWCDs feel that they can make this all happen, when my ditch authorities are saying they can't make these dates happen. And more importantly, my landowners are for sure saying they cannot make these. And yet, and you need to remember, Ms. Becker-Kadelka, that this is their land that we're taking. This is their land that we're affecting. And so this needs to go all the way down. So when Representative Johnson raises his questions about, you know, are they doing it right, all these different questions, and say, no problem, we're going to get it done with this date, I just vehemently disagree with that. And I would think that, I would hope that the department, or the Bowser, would at least recognize what we're dealing with. I have one of the most agricultural districts in this state, and I can tell you the things that you are conveying of what you're hearing out in the field is not even close to what I'm hearing back there. There's a lot of concern, there's a lot of worry, and if one of our biggest things is to make sure that we get this right in the end, I certainly hope that we don't truncate the time just to say that, hey, we got it done in time. So I think what Representative Torkelson has provided as an option to push both dates back to 2018 is the very least that we can do. And I would agree with Representative Lewick that if we start getting into waivers and some of those different things, my ditch authorities and my SWCDs are confused enough as it is as to what's going on. We talked about APO authority. Now it's going to change again. I've talked to them dozens of times as to what that meant, and now that's going to change again. So they're going to have even more fear and more concern about that. I would recommend that we do this in a prudent fashion, which means sometimes it may take a little time, and I think the 2018 pushing all the deadlines back to then is the very least that we can do. Mr. Chair, thank you.
Very good. Representative Mahoney.
You may have already answered this just in your last answer, but who's tracking what's being done? So if you get a waiver, are you alternative practice, kind of like alternative fact, hopefully not. Does somebody go out, okay, building guy, that's what I do. I can go to the building code, and if I can get an engineer to sign off, which I did on my remodel at my home, but I can do something different than the code requires, because it fit better to what we were trying to do with the house. But that's got an architectural drawing. It's got an engineer's stamp on it. It's got an engineer's signature on it. I have a copy. The city has a copy. I don't think the state has a copy. That kind of covers my rear end at the end of the day. So who has a copy of this alternative practice for ditches? Who records that?
Mr. Chair, members, the law provides that is done locally. So that is a local piece. The Soil and Water Conservation District is charged with the implementation, so working with landowners to make it happen. Counties and watershed districts have the ability to elect jurisdiction, so they have the ability to do the compliance and enforcement piece of it if they choose to do so, and that all happens locally. And so I think one of your specific questions was around the validation of compliance, and so the Soil and Water Conservation District, they are the ones that would locally have the authority to go in, and if a farmer or landowner comes in and says, I've done the right thing, I want a piece of paper that says that I have validation that this is compliance, that all happens at the local level.
Representative Mahoney.
So then, who all has the copy? Is it just the farmer that has the copy, or does the Soil and Water District have to keep a copy, or does the county have to keep a copy of that validation that they did the right thing?
Ms. Becker-Kadanka.
Mr. Chair and members, it would be a copy provided to the landowner and also stored at the Soil and Water Conservation District.
Okay. And one other thing here.
One more follow-up.
You know, everybody keeps talking about pushing dates back and pushing dates back and pushing dates back. You know, at some point, you just have to say you've got to get it done. Because, frankly, the buffer zone is really the protection for the farmers against the Des Moines lawsuit at some point. You know, and if you don't get it done, somebody's going to file a lawsuit. Not me. Maybe some city along the place where they're pouring water out of it. But the sooner you get this done, the more protection you have. So I don't understand why you keep pushing it back, because there's always some hungry lawyer out there. Excuse me. That's just a comment.
No, I understand your concern, but we got to get it done. But I think with the uncertainty of the funding, and then, you know, we've talked about some of the weeds coming in and trying to make sure we have good, clean seed used to seed in these strips, I think some caution, at the very least, is prudent as we look at getting these things done correctly. Any more questions, or Representative Bly?
Thank you, Chair. So it reminds me of other discussions we've had where different agencies are working with folks to comply with whatever it might be, that there's a trust issue, that, you know, are we going to be treated fairly and all of that. And I'm very encouraged in the conversations I've had with the DNR and with Bowser about their willingness to work through these issues, that the goal is to get it accomplished and do it in a way where we're solving problems, not punishing people or fining people or whatever, which is very encouraging. I did, in a conversation, and I can't speak to the veracity of this, but a concern that if a Soil and Water County District decides that they're just going to do buffers, they're not going to look at alternative practices, what happens? What is the farmer's recourse if he feels like that the Soil and Water supervisor is not working with them or whatever? Can they go somewhere and say, you know, I'd like to try some, have a conversation about alternative practices, and my Soil and Water people are not doing that?
Who wants to tackle that one?
Mr. Chair and Representative, it's a good question, and I think the overall piece is that we all feel like there are these issues, and we're working through these issues. And so, to your point, it's not that everything is perfect by all means. I think the forward momentum has been very, very encouraging in how it's been working. So we've been working really closely with the Soil and Water Conservation Districts to provide alternative practice options. And so the law does not prescribe the board to oversee or come up with alternative practices. The law does not prescribe that. Our role is to support local decision-making, provide input, help our local SWCDs as they're working through what alternative practices might be. What we've found and what we've been requested by legislators, by soil and waters, by local governments, by citizens, is to offer some common examples of what alternative practices might look like or might be. And so what the board has been working on now is to come up with what might common sense examples be and look like. And so that's based on, this is not prescribed in law, so we are not directing that people must use this suite of alternative practices. Rather, it's something that after we've gotten that feedback, that very piece is that if a soil and water conservation district is struggling with what kinds of alternative practices may look, here are some examples of common ones. So this is what happens if you've got a berm, and you know, and we've heard the one of water doesn't run uphill. So how do we take a look at maybe a 50-foot buffer isn't appropriate here? How do we, you know, talk about, let's stabilize the bank, the soil and water district, let's look and see if there's a pipe that's going into the water. Does it make sense to buffer around where the water gets into, you know, the public water or public drainage system? And so those types of things are what the board is working on right now to help soil and water conservation districts in their work.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, could I just add on to that? What I would say in terms of your specific question about what recourse does the landowner have, the law is very specific that the landowner has a choice. It's the buffer of the width specified or in alternative practices. And in fact, if you even look at the heading of the section, it refers to a riparian protection requirement. It's not even titled buffer. So they can choose to go to the Soil and Water Conservation District to get a validation. They're not required to do so under the law. So, you know, I think the recourse is if the Soil and Water Conservation District said you don't have a buffer, you are out of compliance, as that got forwarded to the County Watershed District, or, you know, in the rare cases that Bowser might be the enforcing authority, the recourse is they are compliant with the law at that point. And so I would find it difficult to believe that at that point the county, the watershed district, or Bowser would find the landowner out of compliance under the terms of the law.
Thank you.
Very good.
In fact, just a little comment. Having worked with my soil and water folks and farmers, I know they do a very good job in exploring different options as farmers run into different problems. So I know it can work. Yeah. Thank you.
Let's hear from the DNR.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. The Department of Natural Resources would reiterate the comments made by Bowser on the whole bill, so I'm not going to repeat all of those. I'm going to focus on the specific sections of the bill that relate to the Department of Natural Resources. And again, our primary role in this effort is to develop the map that demonstrates the water bodies, where buffers are required, and what that buffer width is. So specifically with Section 4 of the bill, which is the section that makes the change on public waters, of taking those public waters that do not have a shoreline classification and removing them from the 50-foot category and instead placing them in the 16.5-foot category, we do have some concerns with this change. First of all, it's important for us all to understand that category of watercourses without a shoreline classification includes both natural watercourses as well as altered watercourses. So while the emphasis is on these private ditches that are also public waters, it does also include natural watercourses. We have no easy way to distinguish between the two without a lengthy research process. So that creates some issues. What this does in practice in terms of what is getting a buffer requirement on the ground is that it has the potential to remove 48,000 miles of buffer from that 50-foot category and downgrade them to the 16.5-foot category. Another way of looking at it is it's about a 70% reduction in the watercourse miles that are currently mapped as 50 feet. So again, I want to be clear, they're not being removed from any buffer protection, but they are being removed from the 50-foot buffer to a 16.5-foot buffer. The other thing that I would just point members to, and we did distribute a handout. What this handout does is provide the data from the DNR's comment process on the map. So just to be clear on the process, we issued a preliminary buffer map last March. We issued a what I will call a field-ready buffer map in July, and then we had two scheduled updates after that, one in November and then one here just a week ago. And throughout that entire time period, we took comments on the map. So when we started this process, because the map was created from existing data, it either derived from the public water inventory, which as Representative Torkelson said was done in the late 70s, early 80s. That was the source for the public water data. The source for the public ditch data, literally we had to go out to 90-some different drainage authorities, counties and watershed districts, and collect either digital data if they have it or paper data if they had it that had to be digitized. So it is not a surprise to us that we were going to have to receive some comments and make some corrections to the map. We received just about 4,200 comments over this time period. It resulted in about 2,700 or 2,800 changes to the map, and you'll see those statistics here, 2,762 changes to the map. If you look on the back side of that, what we've done is categorize the comments by their topic. And so if you look at the very bottom of that table on the second page, this is the category of these public water courses that are also considered to be a private ditch by the landowner. We have only received 80 comments in that category. So 80 out of the 4,200 comments are landowners with that issue. Now, I fully respect that for many of those people, it's a very emotional issue. It's very frustrating because they did not realize prior to this that their water was also public water. And so I have no doubt that out of all of these comments, disproportionately, that's probably what you as legislators are hearing about. But I did want to share, we have tracked all these 4,200 comments, and we have 80 in that category. And so as we look at this, we have a very blunt tool being proposed here to address a very small minority of comments, and we think that the provision in the current law that allows all of these landowners to use alternative practices to put in something that is less than a 50-foot buffer is very doable given this number. And I'm sure there may be some more out there that we find, but again, we're in a very small category here. So I'd be happy to answer any questions about the map of the comment.
Questions from members? Seeing none. Oh, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question relates similar to the question I asked Ms. Becker to Kudelka, and that is that timelines are count on this. There are still pending cases. We're all aware of those pending cases, and when can we anticipate those cases to be resolved? And obviously, can they be resolved in time for the farmer to be able to make the decisions they need to make, whether it be respective to alternative practices and or choosing to put in the buffer?
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's a great question. If you look at the data on the comments by disposition, so out of the 4,193 comments, there are 47 of them that are still open. Just 7 of those are requiring field review. Those are the more intensive review. So we're down to a very small number of the comments that we've received that are still open, and we will have those done well in advance of folks needing to put in buffers. I do want to be clear, we are not cutting off comments because we don't want anybody, if they have failed over this time period, to come forward with a comment. We will still take those and we will still process them. But I will tell you that comments are what was sort of a flood in the beginning has slowed to a trickle because a lot of those people did come in early after the maps were first released.
Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would encourage you to encourage the SWCDs to talk to the people, because in my district alone, I've had 3 people that have come to me who have said they have concerns about the classification for their waterway, and they've gone to the SWCDs and they've said, well, you can make comment, but it's not going to change now, so you might as well just forget about it. So that list that you have, there's many more behind that you're just being told, don't talk about it and move on. So as we move forward, if the DNR truly wants to make sure that we get all this right, which I believe you do, okay? Make sure that it's abundantly clear down into the ditch authorities and the soil and water conservation districts that people still can express their concerns, because we have this, it might be truncated and gone to a trickle because there's a lot of people who think they have nowhere to go. One of the biggest questions we get is if we still, Representative Johnson, I think, alluded to this. I apologize if it wasn't him, but we have people that still have questions that feel that aren't being answered by the SWCDs, and I'm not here to criticize them. I'm just saying that if they feel that the SWCDs aren't giving them the proper answers, we ask the question, who can they talk to after that? And I kind of heard, well, work with it with the SWCD. That's fine. So I'm asking the two departments to make sure to make it abundantly clear to the SWCDs that if people still have concerns, that they have the ability to go to talk to the DNR about it. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members, I think that's a great suggestion and absolutely a great follow-up for us to do.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Miller, I would just add that we are encouraging folks to do that. We are encouraging SWCDs, and you know, many of them are. Whether you think you know the answer, please go ahead and submit the comment, partly because this is how we're tracking data, and so it makes that process more robust. The other thing that we are letting them know is that if a landowner or if the SWCD has a disagreement with the disposition that they find in the comment tool, they should contact their DNR area hydrologist to have a further conversation and have an opportunity to work that out. So to your point, we are making that available.
Just one real quick comment. Promise is really quick. I do think that this blunt tool that you're talking about is actually a good tool, because what I'm finding in my district is this public waterway is kind of becoming the real thing, you know, 16 and a half versus 50. And I think if we just clarify it through what Representative Torkelson has proposed, it may be a blunt tool, but it'll probably take the burden off of DNR to have to follow up with a lot of these individual questions, because this is really where the heart of it is what I see left in my district. So thank you.
Representative Backer.
Chair, and thank you. And I know I talked to Angie about this, but I do want to bring this up again, because this is a real issue in my district. Now, this property, we were able to get it out of the public water course. But as people see, this was pictured, if you look real closely, the night before was 1.8 inches of rain. And if you look on the map, this is classified as a public water course shoreline. They've been fighting with this since grandfather and great-grandfather, and I have tons of this in my district. And next Wednesday, I'm having a meeting with the DNR with another one of these that's classified in Stevens County. So I can appreciate that there's only 80, and I'm not here to be cynical, but we have this situation is not being addressed, and I have talked to Representative Torkelson, and we're going to continue to work on this. But this is what happens when you pass a bill quickly and don't see it vent. So it's a real issue. I will continue to work with the DNR and Bowser on this, because I got a number of these in my district. So thank you.
Yeah, I would agree. A lot of folks were surprised to look at these new maps and find they have public waters on their maps, because back in the 70s, it didn't really make a lot of difference to a farmer if his land had public waters, but it does today.
Mr. Chair, can I just clarify to that particular picture? I'm glad Representative Becker showed that picture. So, again, if you go to the handout and to the second page, the larger table there under the comments by category, and the first one is field reviews, and the third line under that is farmed public water course. And so there you'll see 160. So this is in a different category from those public waters that are also private, which is, I think, what you're showing would be one of those farmed water courses there. And so if you look, we've done 683 of these field reviews. Mr. Chair, that would also include the public waters that are now in a tile that you mentioned. I think it's our process on this is, because the bill is a water quality riparian protection bill, if there is no water, is it a farm through water course with no defined bed and bank and no flow, as the picture that Representative Backer showed, we are removing those from the map because there is no water to accomplish the purpose of the law. Same with tiled public waters. If there is no flow there, we can't accomplish the purpose of the bill. So those are being removed from the map, and you see those numbers indicated in this table.
Thank you.
I'll follow.
Okay, follow-up revision. And I appreciate that, but it's still classified as a public water course. I know it's being removed as a map, but when you own the land and you're paying $5,000 an acre, it comes from a different point of view. I do appreciate it, but we still have several issues that we'll be working through with the DNR and Bowser through that. Angie and I have had many conversations, and we'll continue to do that.
Any final comments for our testifiers? And thank you very much for coming in today. We thought this was going to be a short presentation. We have a couple more testifiers. Mark, Ken, thank you very much. Mark, Ken Ike, and Trevor Russell, if you want to come down. Okay. We hope you could put off your meeting, Chair Torkelson. Okay. Go ahead and identify yourselves, and let's hear your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Mark Tenite from the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy. My name is Trevor Russell with Friends of the Mississippi River.
Okay, go ahead.
The Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy, MCEA, is a Minnesota nonprofit organization using law, science, and research to protect Minnesota's environment, its natural resources, and the health of its people. We have programs in both water quality and wildlife and natural resources, so we're very interested in buffers and alternative practices. We have over the years worked with the agricultural community to find ways to do flood damage reduction and to do drainage in a fashion that will accomplish the producer's goals as well as improve water quality and wildlife habitat. We were founding members of the drainage work group, which is stakeholder sort of thing, looking for consensus solutions to some of these water quality and wildlife issues. So 50-foot buffers filter pollutants, and they provide corridors for wildlife. So we're, I'm going to say it again, 50 feet. 50 feet is really kind of the bottom edge of what you need to accomplish wildlife and water quality benefits. The 16.5-foot buffers are largely a ditch maintenance feature. And just before I address the policy concerns we have with this, but I want to say we strongly support the funding to the counties and the watershed districts to implement and enforce the 2015 buffer law. And we agree with what's been discussed this morning and in other committees that very often an alternative practice is a better solution than a buffer. So we're involved in talking to Bowser about the alternative practices, and we really think they may be where the biggest gain can come in many instances from the buffer law. But we do have, I think, three or four concerns with the policy pieces and really the four concerns with House File 1994. The first addresses what DNR talked about. Losing 48,000 miles of buffer is a big concern. Moving it from the 50-foot category to the 16.5 is really a monumental change. To go from 70 or 80,000 acres down, take 48,000 off of that, is about a 70% reduction. So if you look at it that way, this House File 1994 will put us back with less buffer than we had in 2015. So this is not just a rollback of the 2015 law, it's a rollback that goes beyond what we had in, reduces what we had in buffer in even 2015. So that's a big concern to us. The other major concern we have that hasn't been discussed this morning is the requirement that a buffer is only required if it's funded 100% by state or local funding, and that corrective action is not in order unless a landowner has declined to accept 100% state or federal funding. Not, I think I misspoke when I said local. The bill refers to state or federal, so it's state or federal funding. If you look at the history of water quality infrastructure in the state and in the country, it's been a public-private partnership, really. Some money private, some money public. I think the best example in this context is stormwater. Stormwater ponds are required of businesses and real estate developments in the urban area. And when those stormwater ponds are constructed, it's very similar to a buffer. And it accomplishes quite a few of the same purposes. In most cases, either the developer or the business, or in my case, I pay a quarterly charge for stormwater treatments in our area. So I just think that we need to think this through and look at ways to have it be a public-private partnership and not one solely paid by state or federal funding.
Mr. Hike, I would interject there that even if the state or somebody paid for the buffer, the farmer is giving up the land. So wouldn't that be a substantial contribution on his part?
It would be, and I guess that's a place where maybe some clarification is in order, that the testimony in other committees has been that cost would include the cost of the land, that the landowner would have to be fully compensated for the land in addition to the installation of the buffer. So there's a big difference there, and Mr. Chairman and committee members. So I understand the question, maybe it's a question for clarification, but the testimony elsewhere has been that the land costs would also be included.
Well, as I understand, it was for the implementation of the buffer. In the governor's plan, he proposes that $40 payment for 5 years, which would basically, cover the establishment of the buffer. So, okay, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you. And I think I've covered that point. So I just would say we do also have concerns with the APO authority. I understand that counties and watersheds are not likely to use the APO authority, and that's fine. They have local ordinances and rules that will work just great. I do think that it's the penalties in other areas of water quality, water permitting, the penalties are fairly significant, and I think it's a good idea to keep some monetary penalty in the law. That's not one of our two major concerns, but I think it's a good thing to have as a default, if you will. And finally, there's been a fair amount of testimony that the things are going well, encouraged by the what's been done on the ground already, and we think the law does not need to be amended to change the dates at this point. And thank you.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Russell, and the time is becoming of the essence here, so go ahead.
Mr. Chair, I understand Trevor Russell, Friends of the Mississippi River. I'll just begin by offering our appreciation for the work that Representative Torkelson has done to address issues associated with the buffer law. We may not agree on all aspects of the bill, but we really appreciate and respect his work to try to get the buffer law moving and address other water quality issues in Minnesota. So we may disagree on this, but we have a lot of respect for the work that he's done. And we do support some provisions of the bill. In the original draft, anyway, beginning with lines 4.16 and Section 5B, allowing local governments flexibility in choosing when they would want to adopt jurisdiction. We think that makes a lot of sense. We have no opposition to that. We also strongly support the funding provisions in the other version of Representative Bill. I won't touch on Sections 1, 4, and 5 that Mr. Tanak and others have talked about, but I do want to offer our perspectives on the shoreline classification issue. The provision aims to exclude public waters from the 50-foot buffer or alternative protection if they don't have a shoreline classification. And the DNR has indicated that would be maybe 48,000 miles, or about 70% of all public waters, losing that 50-foot buffer protection, including many miles of streams that likely already have a buffer in place and would potentially lose that 50-foot buffer protection if this language goes into effect. And the reason is that many miles of natural water course that anyone in this room would look at and say, well, that's a public water, that's a stream, that should have a 50-foot buffer, don't have a shoreline classification overlay on them. And county shoreline classifications are local zoning codes that are pretty wildly inconsistent from county to county, and in some places a public water loses its shoreline classification at a section line or a county line. and it wasn't intended to act as a surrogate for water resource protection management. We do understand the intent here. The intent is noble. There are cases where we would all look at something and say, that's a ditch, it looks like a ditch, it's shaped like a ditch, it's got berms on both sides. A 50-foot buffer isn't going to do you a whole lot of good. So we're respectful of that issue. We feel that there's two solutions that are already built into the law, so we don't need this language. The first is the change request process that the DNR has highlighted, and we're grateful for them that they're keeping that process open so they can work with landowners like Representative Becker and Representative Miller have mentioned in comments today. And the second is the alternative practice component that's already in the law. So if something was a 50-foot buffer and it's got berms between the buffer and the creek, the alternative practice component is designed specifically to address that. 50-foot berm buffer isn't going to do any good. Work with local experts, help modify that to get a better, more useful conservation practice that's built into the law. We'd like to see that moving rather than apply language that would fundamentally change what is our understanding of what public buffer waters are and public waters are not in a way that would remove maybe 70% of public water 50-foot buffer or alternative protections from our state. We think that in aggregate that would take the state backwards, not forward. So it's a noble intent. We understand the problem trying to be solved. This language is a tool that maybe does a lot more harm to the aggregate buffer protections of our state than it provides benefit to a small handful of landowners that are aggrieved over a public water designation. In short, I think the buffer law overall appears to be working okay. There are isolated examples where folks are upset. We understand you're going to hear pretty loudly from those people, but we'd like to see the DNR allowed to continue working through this process, deploy alternative practices where appropriate, modify the buffer maps if there's a clear problem with it, rather than applying language that would really fundamentally change the nature of public water buffer protections in Minnesota. Mr. Chair, thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Russell. Any questions? If not, any final comment? Anybody in the audience who would care to offer testimony? Not seeing anybody. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This question is for Representative Torkelson. I'm curious about the soil loss ordinance on 2.4 and 2.5. I heard a little bit about this in the ENR committee, and I want to make how many counties have this ordinance?
Chair Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Johnson. I do not know. There has been an effort at Bowser to do a statewide ordinance, and I'm not even sure of the exact progress of that. I doubt that we want to delve into that right now because I know the chair is on a timeline. And I'd be happy to talk about this with you offline.
I just want to make a comment quickly, and that is that, you know, I've been in situations with farmers who say, you know, what my neighbor's doing is really wrong. And I hope that they have a mechanism whereby they can report that. And I would hope that this language would not restrict that for farmers in those counties that don't have that ordinance. Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Torkelson, any final comments?
Just a couple of quick comments, Mr. Chair. First, I would just highlight that as far as the APO authority goes, the successful counties that have already reached a very high percentage of compliance have done so without APO authority, so it certainly can be done. Second, I would just also reemphasize that this is a water quality issue. It's not a land grab. It's not a wildlife habitat establishment program. And the change in going from 50 feet to 16 and a half feet is not about, shouldn't be about we want to take more land out of production. It should be about water quality. That's what we should be focused on. And I'm happy to work with DNR and Bowser to continue to refine this process and make it as effective and fair as possible. Thank you for your patience, Mr. Chair. Nothing with buffers goes quickly.
Very good. With that, I renew my motion that the House File 1494, as amended, be referred to the Committee on Environment and Natural Resources. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
No.
The motion passes. You're back on your way, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And again, I didn't anticipate this long on this bill, and we do have testifiers here from outstate on House File 1720. It would be my wish that we could finish that bill this morning, and even if we have to go past noon a little bit to accommodate those outstate testifiers, and then we will reconvene at 3 o'clock or 3:30? 3:30 this afternoon in room 300 North to take up the ag policy bill. So again, trying to get all these things in deadline week is a challenge. So let's move to House File 1720. again, because we have testifiers here from who've come a long ways, and we want to respect their time. And we will continue and finish this bill yet in our morning session here today. Representative Backer, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, I move this bill that, thank you. I move that House File 1720 be referred to the Property Tax and Local Government Finance Division. I do also, Chair, have an amendment. I would like to move that.
You have an amendment, the A-17 for your amendment, Representative Backer.
Yeah, it just gets it in order. We clarify the date of 2017 instead of having 2018 and 2017, and I have testifiers that will be talking about why we did that and so forth. So we would like to get it out together.
Discussion on the A-17 amendment. If none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Do you all have the amendment, by the way? I think so. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The amendment's adopted. To your bill, Vice Chair, as amended.
Okay, I'm going to be very brief so we can get the testifiers in. In 1992, there was a law passed that talked about how to assess for property taxes on ag containment. Long story short, it wasn't necessarily assessed correctly, and just in 2015, the Department of Revenue changed that on their guidance on how county assessors should assess it. That created a lot of challenges, especially in smaller communities, where what we were doing was shifting property tax from ag containment to seniors and other people in the community. So we were just distributing that burden to other people. I have been working with all the stakeholders for well over a year and a half. I mean, several meetings, and we did come up with this language that we agreed upon last year. Now that we do have some of the stakeholders, not necessarily, you will hear testimonies today that would will not support the language, is my suspicion, and they'll tell you why. But I want to let the members know that we have worked together, had agreement. It did not get passed out of the tax bill because it wasn't signed. So with that said, I'm going to turn over to testifiers so the people can testify, and thank you, and I can ask questions later.
And we have quite a list. First up, Kelly Pearson. Is Kelly here? And then Jenny Hazleton. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, Kelly, come on down. And then we have Gary Carlson and Jenny Hazleton. And again, we want to respect those that have come in from a long ways away, so we try to get those folks up here first. Go ahead, sir, and identify yourself and proceed.
Mr. Chair, thank you for the opportunity to speak here. Before I get started, I also want to thank the companies that are here also, the chemical companies, for being part of our community. They're our friends, they're our neighbors, and we'd like it to stay that way even after this is done. I want to talk about some of the effects of how Winthrop has been, how we have felt the effects of this exemption. Our overall tax capacity will be reduced by $103,000, or about 15%. This is in addition to the $75,000 we lost last year to a different interpretation on ethanol storage facilities. Residential property taxes will increase another 30% plus due to this new interpretation. This, in addition to the 20% increase from last year with the ethanol exemption. The city will have to levy an additional $35,000 in property taxes per year through 2025 to cover the debt service still owed on improvements to our industrial park, which should have been paid through tax abatements by these companies. The additional reduction in tax capacity could adversely affect our A-plus credit rating, which costs us more money in general obligation bonds. The city has invested over $1 million in improvements to our industrial park to meet the needs of the existing companies and also to bring industry into town and help increase our tax base and ease the tax burden on our residents. We rely heavily on our aid partners to substantiate our taxes. Shifting this tax burden from the industrial park will have a devastating effect and has had a devastating effect on the 1,400 residents who live in Winthrop. Median hourly wages average $12 to $15 an hour. and a substantial increase for our property tax will have residents possibly moving out of town. Our industrial park will end up creating the exact opposite outcome of what we intended when we began improvements. I think it is unfair to shift that burden to small businesses and residents who call with their home and give relief to the bigger corporations who are more able to afford to pay the taxes. We all want to be good neighbors, but this will only create more hardships for our residents and make it much more difficult to entice people to move to Winthrop. This year alone, we have to cut our budget. We cut $75,000 out of our budget. That is a lot for a small town. We also put off hiring a full-time police officer, which we had anticipated and had budgeted for previously. We have higher expenses when it comes to our fire department and ambulances so that we are prepared to handle any type of a chemical fire, which could be dangerous. We've had to actually cut some of our capital expenses in our fire department for replacement of various trucks and equipment that would be used to fight this. Increased costs for infrastructure maintenance due to the larger trucks. I don't know if you've ever seen the trucks or the size of the actual trucks that put that the applicators that go into the fields, but they're quite large and they do some damage to our local roads or in the city. These companies have not taken advantage of this in 25 years. They've never used it. We have worked hard to bring businesses into our community, have invested millions in the process. So please do not penalize us for our efforts. We've worked hard to get them there, and we'd like to stay there. We're asking that those companies pay for their fair share of the cost to this community. This will affect many, many of our constituents, your constituents actually also, in a very adverse and painful way, and that is through their checkbook. So that is if this is not corrected. So I hope that you do take a look at this and that this is corrected. And I'd like to, again, thank you for your time.
Thanks, Mr. Pearson. And any questions for either he or Ms. Hazelton? Any comments, ma'am?
Chairman, I would just like to say that I can't stress enough how important this repeal is to the citizens of Winthrop. This has hit our businesses hard with increased taxes, and we also have a considerable low-income population who have been affected. I have been communicating with many of the other cities impacted by this and keeping them up to date on the progress. It's about more than just the city of Winthrop. There are many small towns all over Minnesota just like us who are struggling before this exemption came about. This just makes it harder for small towns like us to survive.
Okay. Thank you, ma'am. Any questions from members? If not, thank you very much for coming in this morning.
Thank you.
We have Gary Carlson. And on deck, Bill Bond and Craig Maurer. Good morning.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Gary Carlson with the League of Minnesota Cities. I haven't provided the committee with a handout, so I'm going to cut my testimony very short, except I want you to know that League of Minnesota Cities strongly supports Representative Backer's bill with the amendment that goes on to that. So there's a handout that does itemize the most impacted cities in your committee packet, and I encourage you to look at that list because many of our communities are losing a tremendous amount of tax base as of this tax year due to the expanded exemption interpretation as a result of Section 23 of 27202. So we encourage your support for the bill, and I'll stand for any questions.
Thank you. Questions? If not, thanks for your brevity. Bill Bond and Craig Maurer next, and then we have Patrick Murray, and then Dan Whitman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Bill Bond on behalf of Minnesota Crop Production Retailers, and I have with me a board member as well, Craig, who I'll introduce in a minute. First of all, I want to respectfully thank Representative Backer and other legislators that worked very diligently to come up with language that would be acceptable to all the parties. We do not support the language as it will be amended or as it stands. Our perspective on this is long. In 1992, the state of Minnesota decided it was good public policy because of the federal and state required containment primary and secondary, for these chemical facilities, that they should be exempted from property tax assessment. We found years later, and we prompted a bill in the other body that would eliminate this exemption, primarily because the assessors apparently didn't understand the exemption. It wasn't applied in many, many counties. The apparent solution seemed to be, let's eliminate the exemption. We think that was unjustified and unfair. The Department of Revenue clarification simply made every assessor aware of what the law said, and we think that's appropriate. We've handed out for you a packet, and essentially it points out the tremendous effort across the country that our industry, primarily farmer-owned cooperatives, have gone to make sure that their facilities are safe, and that we have trained many emergency responders, and many of them, in fact, serve on the local fire departments that respond to these emergencies. And that brings up a case in point. You may have heard of the recent tornado in Clark's Grove, and we have here to talk about that and give you a couple examples of why this containment is important, not only for liquid chemicals, but for a fertilizer that is in solid bulk form, that when water hits it, becomes a EPA-defined hazardous waste. And so with that, Mr. Craig Maurer.
Go ahead, sir, your name, and then proceed.
Hi, my name is Craig Maurer. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm a board member for the Minnesota Crop Retailers, and also work for Central Farm Service as an operations manager. Monday afternoon at 5:30, we were hit by a tornado, and it's really, really amazing that we were talking about the same thing here. What happened there, we lost, that whole facility is totally ruined. And if you look through the pictures there that you have, you can see what containment does as far as the difference of losing that container, holding the containment water on the facility, and what it does for you, and why we build these facilities to contain those types of things. The first picture is dry fertilizer. You can see where rainwater has hit that, and it's starting to melt down. That facility right there, we lost about 150 feet of roof on that building there, and we got rain in there. The second page shows where what the rainwater is and why it's contained, all the debris from the tornado, and everything that happened there, and that containing that rinsate water, what you want to call it, or rainwater that's mixed in there and contained that, so it's not runoff and not going into ditches and ponds and stuff like that. And the third picture is also a picture of what runoff in there from the storm, the water, and it's contained and not running down into ditches and streams or a city waterworks or stuff like that. So we need containment in these facilities. We need to roof them, and we need to protect our environment by doing that. The agriculture community, as retailers, we want to do that, and we've spent the money to do it. We're following the law, and we want to meet those goals and contain our safe environment that we have right now. So,
Mr. Maurer, these are from Monday's storm?
Yes, it is.
Hopefully nobody hurt?
No, actually, it happened at 5:30, and we're on our winter hours right now, so all our employees were gone at 5. It's very catastrophic what happened there. Oh. We're still in cleanup mode, and this facility will probably take 2 years to put that back into full operations.
So, good luck with that huge job you have ahead of you.
It's a very large undertaking, yeah. You know, and it's, after we get through insurance and everything else, it'll be a shortfall for us, I know that. But thank you, sir, and I appreciate the chance to talk.
Yeah, thank you for coming up today. Any questions from members? If not, again, thank you. Patrick Murray and Dan Whitman on deck.
Chair Anderson, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity. Patrick Murray with Cooperative Network. Cooperative Network is a two-state trade group of cooperatives of all kinds in Minnesota and Wisconsin. We represent over 400 members. And the reason why I wanted to get on to the record, I wanted to dovetail some of the comments that were made by Mr. Bond and Mr. Maurer, and to let folks know that we want to continue to work on the legislation here with Representative Backer. We appreciate the Vice Chair's work on this issue over the last several years. However, we feel that the way the language is written right now, it very much narrows the scope of what would be exempt. And when you look at it from the co-op's perspective, You can look at it from a taxpayer's perspective as well, but the co-op is one of the larger job providers typically in the community. They pay payroll taxes, they pay property taxes, and a lot of folks that work at the co-op are taxpayers as well. So we look at it as a potential affront on having this exemption for the facilities that those folks have in place and that are required and mandated by law. So the last thing I would like to mention is the DOR's guidance document that was issued in 2005. We think that that does a very good job to give communities and assessors an idea of what is exempt and what isn't exempt property-wise. So we would contend that that's a very good piece of information that the Department of Revenue came out with. But that being said, we still would like to continue to work with Representative Backer, members of the committee, as we go through this process. So that's all I have. I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions from members? If not, thank you.
Thank you.
And our last testifier, at least on the list here, is Mr. Dan Whitman. Good morning.
Good morning. Almost afternoon, but my name is Dan Whitman. I'm the county assessor in Martin County, and I'm also today representing the Association of Assessing Officers on the legislative committee there. I really appreciate the opportunity to briefly talk to you all. And I very much appreciate Representative Backer's all the work that we've been working together here for, like you said, over a year to try to negotiate this. I guess, as county in Martin County, I can give you all the numbers that the folks from Winthrop did. I've got two ethanol plants, and I've got several of these large ethanol or egg containment facilities. Lots of tax shift in our county, I won't do that because it's already been talked about. I'll talk mainly about, as the assessing organization, we really felt like that up until 2015, PACE 16, the assessors in Minnesota, were the large majority were doing things the same way. Then we received a directive in the fall of 15, which for a payable 17, made a large shift. We feel like it was a very large shift that caused all of us to do things, or the vast majority to do things differently than what we've been doing since 1992. And so with that, for me, and I think about a dozen other counties, we received then a tax court petition shortly after that a directive was given, which that's why we needed the change, the amendment today to retroactive to 16, because without that, the logic of petition, the tax court petition was, well, if it was supposed to be exempt in payable 17, it should have been exempt last year, too, before, before we made the big change under the directive from the department. And so that's why we're very supportive of the overall bill, but mostly I'm talking about that amendment that goes back to 2016, because without that we're trying to eliminate this big yo-yo thing that happened up until payable 16. We were doing it pretty much the same. All of a sudden for 17 we've got a huge shift where everything went exempt, and with the passage of this bill it'll go back up again for payable 18. And then about a dozen counties, we're going to have issues in 2000 in the tax court for payable 16. So there's 2 years in play here for at least a dozen counties, 1 year in play for virtually the whole state, where we'll be just different than what we've done for a long time. So, I can go on for hours, but this is, we're talking about a significant tax shift that we're trying to eliminate on our people. Kind of go back the way we were doing it for years and years, which we believe was the original legislative intent. The way they did farming in 1992, this was put in place, we believe, the berms that kept everything together, kept it contained. That's what we believe that original intent was. As things have changed in the last 25 years, all of a sudden there's a lot more involved, and it's become a huge dollar thing. That's not what everyone was applying for years, so. I can answer questions, like I say, forever, but I understand it's getting late.
Mr. Whitman, just to clarify then, when Revenue made their clarifying statement,
yes,
That took effect for payable 16, or is it now for payable 17?
The directive was, Mr. Chair, the directive was in August of 2015 for the 16 assessment, which is payable 17. So payable this year is the first time there was a lot of exemption in play. So this will be the first year where we're seeing a very large shift in the tax.
So being those statements have already gone out with, I assume, different tax bills for payable coming up in May.
Well, yeah, they're printing mine tomorrow. So they're in the, yeah, it's unchangeable for this for the tax statements.
Okay. So how would that be handled?
It won't be very easy for sure, but again, without it, we just got this 100 and whatever, $60 or $70 million shift. Next year, if this were to pass with next year, I think the original language was, we've got that big yo-yo thing.
Okay, we're just trying to shrink that that year of tax shift, like $160-170 million. That's why we put in the 2016. There's nothing can be done with this year. It's already in front.
And Mr. Jay, this wouldn't be the first time that we've had to do something like this.
Okay. Any other questions from members? This is an interesting topic, and I'm sure it's not been easy to come to a kumbaya feeling on this one. Representative Backer.
Yeah, we have worked really hard. From my perspective, it's really a rock in a hard place. You know, I'm an area just like Representative Miller. We have more farm co-ops than anybody. My neighbors behind me is in the co-op. So this has been a very difficult. What I really tried to do, work with the stakeholders, bring it back to what was the original intent, and try to create a win-win situation as best as we can. And sometimes creating that win-win situation is sometimes walking away with a little sourness in your everybody walking away from the table with a little sourness in their mouth. So that's my final statements here. I would really ask for a yes so we can move to the property tax and local government finance division. So I would, is there any other questions? If not, I would renew my motion.
Oh, just a second. That's my question.
Oh, okay. It's 12 o'clock, Chair.
Well, are you that hungry?
No, I'm not. I just, I'm trying to be respectful of everybody's time.
Anybody in the audience who care to testify for or against the bill, first of all? Seeing nobody, final comments, Representative Bank?
No, that was my final comments.
Okay, so renew your motion then.
I would renew my motion that House File 1720 as amended be referred to the Property Tax and Local Government Finance Division.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion passes and you're on your way. Thanks.
Thank you, members.
We did pretty well. Again, committee members, we're in recess until 3:30 with the call of the chair in room 300 North. 300 North. A lot of things going on today, so 300 North, 3 o'clock with the call of the chair. I'm sorry, 3:30. 3:30. Okay. 3:30. 300 North.
We're back. Ag policy is back. The next bill on the agenda is House File 1717. Members, the DE2 amendment in your packet was adopted on Tuesday the 7th. Representative Chair Anderson, please move your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I should apologize. I didn't think it was going to take that long in civil law. They didn't get going right on time, and then it took a long time. So I apologize for making all of you wait. So you said to move my bill again. What?
Okay, move. And I can do that. Representative Chair Anderson moves that House File 1717 as amended be referred to the General Register.
Yep. Mr. Chair, are we working off
the DE2 amendment?
We are on the DE2 amendment, yes, Representative Mahoney.
Thank you. Okay, Representative Anderson moves the A6 amendment. Is there any discussion to the amendment, A6?
Mr. Chair, if I may, the A6 amendment is strictly a technical cleanup amendment. It has instances of just cleanup language, so that's pretty much all that does. Line 1.5, again, cleans up, clarifies language about the dairy authority, but otherwise that is a technical amendment, Mr. Chair.
Okay. All those in favor of the A6 amendment say aye.
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 All those opposed say nay. The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Representative Anderson moves the A4 amendment. Is there any discussion to the amendment?
Again, Mr. Chair, that amendment was brought to us in an attempt to remove any ambiguities on page 28, line 14. It strikes out the independent audit firm and inserts a CPA firm licensed under Chapter 326A. So again, just a clarification of who would be qualified to audit in that case.
Okay. Is there any other discussion on that amendment? Okay. Seeing none, all those in favor of the A4 amendment say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed say nay. The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Okay. Representative Mahoney has an A1 amendment. Representative Mahoney, would you like to move your amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And yes, I'd like to move the A1 amendment.
Okay. Discussion to the amendment. Go ahead.
Yes, on page 25, I was trying to find, that's why I asked the DE2 amendment to make sure it was written to the right page. One of the things that I had seen and heard is the AURI Institute had eliminated the word Minnesota on page 25. Line 12. I'm not so sure I want a lot of Minnesota tax dollars or fees going to multiple different places. They do have the ability to establish and work with public and private entities to leverage resources, but I do still like the language that it kind of highlights Minnesota and keeps them more in line with where we're going to spend our dollars, Mr. Chair. And I would ask for a roll call on it.
Okay. The roll call. Representative, is there any other discussion to that amendment? Go ahead, Chair Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I tend to agree with the amendment. I would ask Representative Mahoney, by leaving in lines 13 and 14, that we wouldn't be so strict as to prohibit no contact with out-of-state entities, and if you would agree to that, I would agree to your amendment.
Mr. Chair.
Representative.
Mr. Chair, if we delete that section, that actually does leave the language in. And you can ask staff that to make sure that I'm reading the bill right and reading how we do things right. But if we just delete section 48, and then if we delete section 48, then it's not in the bill, so that language stays in law because we're not addressing it.
Staff? Mr. Sullivan?
Mr. Chair and members, excuse me, Representative Mahoney is correct. If section 48 is removed, then Minnesota statutes section 116B.01 subdivision 1 would be unchanged.
Chair Anderson? I would take that as a friendly amendment.
I suspect I don't need a roll call on the bill, Mr. Chair,
okay.
On the amendment.
So
I'll withdraw my request for a roll call.
Okay. So then we'll hear. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Is there any further discussion?
I'm sorry. Representative Abline, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. And Chair Anderson, I'm glad that you consider that a friendly amendment. I thought we had an understanding when they came and presented that they would leave that in because the language seemed to say it was okay in other circumstances to work with other facilities. But I thought they agreed that it was okay to leave the way it was before. But at any rate, I'm pleased that you have taken it as a friendly amendment.
Well, Chair Anderson, well, again, if the current statute allows them to work out of state, so to speak, that this section would, again, taking it out would say that you can work with more than just Minnesota companies. So, again, I would go along with the amendment.
Representative Mahoney. Mr. Chair, as I said, when you take this out, the language that stays in is the Institute must establish or maintain facilities and work with private and public entities to leverage the resources. That doesn't mean that the other private entities or private or public entities can't be working with an organization in Brazil trying to sell soybeans or Iowa trying to sell seeds. That's not an issue here. The public, you just can't invest. If we left this in, they could then invest in a facility in Iowa, and that's what I'm trying to avoid. I mean, if you were running a company in Minnesota that was a partner with the seed company in Iowa, they could still invest in you.
Representative Miller.
Mr. Chair, I apologize because I'm not getting something. I look at the A1 amendment, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes,
that's up, and I just, for my own sake, and I hate to waste time on this, but I say, it says page 25, delete section 48.
Yep.
Oh, so it's not, so does that include subdivision 1? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That deletes AURI.
No.
How am I missing that?
Mr. Sullivan, we'll let staff answer that.
You can answer it later. I get it. I just want to make sure I'm on the same page.
Mr. Sullivan, go ahead, please.
Okay. Mr. Chair and members, deleting Section 48 would simply remove the proposed change to that statute from the bill. So it wouldn't repeal that subdivision from law, but there just would be no change. So Minnesota would remain before entrepreneurs in that section.
Got it. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Apologize for the confusion there.
Thank you, Representative. Okay, other discussion? Okay, seeing none. Representative Mahoney renews his motion to adopt the A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed say nay. The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Representative Johnson has the A3 amendment. Representative Johnson, would you like to move your amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair, and I would like to ask for a friendly amendment to clean up the language I mentioned to Mr. Sullivan.
A technical amendment?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep. If you go ahead, Mr. Sullivan.
Mr. Chair and members, Representative Johnson's change on the A3 would be on page 1, line 9, delete everything after the close parenthesis. So delete on that line and exempt from regulation under the federal insecticide, fungicide, and then all of page 1, line 10. So that sentence would end at paragraph A, period.
And that's...
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry. I learned this morning that that's redundant, so we're saying it twice.
Okay.
It's already said under Code of Federal Regulations, Title 4, Section...
Okay, so but right now we're discussing amendment 2 with that change. So you're offering that.
Okay.
It's your amendment, so you can offer that change.
Okay,
you're okay.
Thank you.
So, but now discussion to the amendment as technically changed by the author of the amendment.
Mr. Chair, I believe we have to vote on his deleting that language from his amendment.
What's that? Yeah, because he can, that's what I understand, too. He can incorporate, because it's his amendment, so he can incorporate. Now, if I offered it, then we would have to vote on it, because it's not my amendment. So we're okay, because it's his. Go ahead. Mr. Sullivan?
Mr. Chair and members, the amendment is the change is to the A3 amendment, page 1, line 9. Delete everything after the close parenthesis, so delete everything after 152.25 paragraph A, and then page 1, delete all of line 10, and insert a period.
And it's, I've been informed by the staff that it's a technical change, and that's why that can be done by the author of the amendment.
We okay with that, everybody? Okay, so let's further discussion of the A3 amendment. Representative Johnson, to your amendment.
Okay. We heard on Tuesday a number of testifiers talk about the importance of pollinators and the challenges associated with treated seed. And so the purpose of this amendment is to reinsert some of the language that was in the original bill as it came from the Department of Agriculture. And what I heard a lot was that just a need to research, provide education, outreach. And so the purpose of this amendment is to respond to that. And it's kind of it's a slightly different than what was in the original bill. But I think it's, so that's the purpose of this amendment.
Chair Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Johnson, I like parts of your amendment. And I'll just to give you my concerns, the definition of treated seed beginning on line 1.6, this is in the pesticide statute of Minnesota statute, and there is some concern with the definition of treated seed, which is exempt from pesticide regulations currently. There is a concern with putting this definition in that area of statute. So we have to work on that. And we had talked about splitting the amendment. I like what you have beginning on page 2.14 and continuing that the rest of your amendment. And I would ask if you would withdraw the amendment. I would work with you, and I know you work well on these things like ditch mowing and this, so I know we could, and have an amendment for the House floor. And I agree, too, that the best management practices, we need to look at that. The other thing this may entail is a fiscal note. If we say must, I think someplace here it says must, and that may entail more staff someplace. We need to get a handle on if this would entail a fiscal note, but I would, at this point, I wouldn't encourage a yes vote on the entire amendment, but I would say that I would work with you before this bill comes up on the floor and take part of it. The part I think we really would want is the 2.14 to 2.17 to get the department and the university working on best management practices.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Anderson. You know, I deeply respect your thoughts, and I regard them. However, I do want to move this amendment forward. I don't think the department has done a lot of work in the past. My guess is they'd be willing to testify right now to say that they can do this without a cost, without a fiscal note, without the need for a fiscal note. And I think part of it is just kind of recognizing the reality we're in, and that is that treated seed is treated with pesticides. So that I think that this is where it belongs, and I think that the definition does belong. And so I would like to move forward with this amendment, and I would like a roll call on this too as well.
And I would, Mr. Chair.
Chair Anderson, go ahead.
Just add, and I understand where you're coming from, but again, no state in the country has done this yet. And it's a little bit going into some waters that are uncharted in terms of where this may lead. And the concern is increased regulation. And in the treated seed area, planting corn is an operation that a farmer hooks up the tractor to the corn planter. It goes out when conditions are fit, and he plants corn. And there's just a concern about regulation or over-regulation with the seed. Is it going to require the farmers become certified to plant corn now because this is in the pesticide statute? So that's the reason for my hesitancy with the amendment, with the entire amendment.
Do you want to? Representative Johnson.
Yeah, and thank you. And again, I respect that concern. And in a way, you could argue that this is why this amendment is written this way. If you look, the references to regulation were removed from the original. The department's bill had references. You know, the original bill had references to regulation, and I purposely chose to take a modest approach here. And I'm one who believes that there's a wide middle of the road. I talk about that a lot, and this is my genuine attempt to seek that middle of the road. I'm also, I said on the floor the other night, I don't like the term slippery slope. I don't buy into that concept. And so I think this is kind of the middle pathway. Again, we've heard from many testifiers there's deep concern about tree and seeds and pollinators. We know the risk to pollinators. I think Minnesota being the first state, I understand Vermont also has a law statute related to it, or first or second or third state or whatever it is. I think that's kind of what Minnesota does, that we stretch a little bit. And we're seeing, you know, again, I'll just make it a, I know a really successful beekeeper who's now semi-retired but still works with the, he's helping pass along the business. And I asked him just the other night, I said, you know, what is this about? How many bees do you lose? And he said, well, we used to lose in the 20 to 30%. He says, now we're losing half. And we've heard in this committee that there's issues with habitat and there's issues with treated seeds. And this is kind of a step to kind of look, get working on that, and to establish that we need attention towards this. And we also heard in committee that, you know, it's not only the honey, but it's also the many crops that are dependent on that. And I think we all know that in this committee. So yes, it's an ambitious step for Minnesota, but less ambitious than what the department asked for. And so, in my opinion, it's the appropriate way to go. So that's why I'm supporting this amendment.
Mm-hmm. Is there any other discussion on the A3 amendment? Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a question then about the treated seed, the definition. Did Representative Anderson say that there is not a definition at this point? I think I missed that conversation. Sorry.
Chair Anderson.
Okay. Let's ask Chair Anderson.
Okay.
Let's ask research.
Research on Mr. Sullivan, please.
Mr. Chair and Representative Poppy, that's correct. There currently is no definition for treated seed in Chapter 18B.
Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there a definition somewhere, or this is the only place that it could be?
Mr. Sullivan.
Mr. Chair and Representative Poppy, there, to my knowledge, there is no definition anywhere in Minnesota statutes of treated seed. I think it would most likely be in Chapter 18B, Pesticide Control.
A follow-up, Mr. Poppy? Representative Poppy, follow-up, sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate, I think we have two of the most moderate legislators, Representative Anderson and Representative Johnson, kind of discussing this issue, and it's kind of, I think they both would see that there's some benefit to further discussing this, and I know that Representative Anderson is trying to do that without putting this on the bill, but I think that maybe there's a benefit to put it on the bill, and then you'd have the opportunity to do some more discussion and some more consideration of it. And if it doesn't remain fully in the bill when it comes to the floor and or comes back from a conference committee, then I think that might be an outcome. But I guess I'm leaning toward Representative Johnson's concept of if this could be put on the bill, then we can continue to have that dialogue and see what we'd like to do with this, because it does seem to make sense that at some point we should be talking about treated seed somewhere, and if this is the right place for it, we now is a good time as any maybe to put it in. So those are my comments.
Okay, thank you, Representative. Chair Anderson?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. We were talking about this amendment this morning, and there, correct me if I'm wrong, Mr. Sullivan, but I believe there is a place in the statutes where seed is covered, and maybe in the seed statute is where this would be more appropriate. Is there a statute just governing seed?
Mr. Sullivan.
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, yes, there is a separate chapter in Minnesota statutes that contains the state seed law.
Follow up there, Chair. Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have a question for Representative Johnson. Lines 1.6 to 1.9, you talk about the U.S. State Environmental Protection Agency Code of Federal Regulations, Title 40, Section 152.25, Paragraph A. Do you know if staff would know what that paragraph is? That federal regulation, does that cover seed or does that just cover pesticide?
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I need some help on that one.
Would you like one, anything?
Yeah, Mr. Sullivan knows.
Mr. Sullivan, do you know the answer?
Mr. Chair and members, I don't have that federal code piece in front of me right now, but my understanding is that what it does is it provides that treated articles, so pressure-treated wood or some other product that has an insecticide applied or a pesticide applied to it, is not considered a pesticide for purposes of pesticide laws at the state, at the federal, and then by extension at the state level. So treated articles in this case, I understand EPA classifies pesticide-coated seed not as a pesticide, but as a treated article that's therefore not subject to regulation as a pesticide.
Okay. So, Mr. Chair.
Follow up. Representative Mahoney.
I sat through all these committee hearings, and, you know, I'm just a city kid that had to go to the farm during the summer. And I'm still getting even with my cousins. But as I read this amendment, And I particularly like the department's version. I'll be very upfront with you. My belief is that in 5 years or 10 years, we won't, unless we do something, we won't have bees, period. And then the farm communities will be back here looking for substantial rescue somehow or another, whether it's a subsidy for the bees or mechanical pollination of whatever it is that you're growing. This federal law that is in this particular piece does not call it a pesticide. Am I correct, Mr. Sullivan?
Mr. Sullivan?
Mr. Chair and Representative Mahoney, that's correct. This would define treated seeds for purposes of state regulation as those treated articles that are not subject to federal regulation.
Correct. Mr. Mahoney. Then, Representative Mahoney.
So we're not classifying the seed as a pesticide. We're asking this amendment, ask the commissioner to be responsible to develop guidance and best practices. It doesn't say he or she would come down with the heavy hammer and beat the snot out of you. You know, and you were fine with the rest of the amendment. So, I mean, this is, you know, I'm just a big city liberal. This is pretty milquetoast. So anyhow, this is your wish. I think you called for a roll call. I'll let it go, but I think this is a, you're not calling a pesticide. You're asking for a commissioner to come up with best guidance practices and whatever else. So I don't think this is a heavy-handed amendment, but I do think it starts that conversation so that you don't have another big problem 5 or 10 years down the road coming at us.
Chair Anderson.
Mr. Chair and representatives, yeah, it does start the conversation. I agree with that, except it does place a new definition of something that's not a pesticide in the pesticide statute, and I think there's a little bit of hesitation to go down that road, not the slippery slope, but go down the road of having this defined in state statute
in the pesticide section that it would make it easier next year, 2 years down the road, or whatever, to institute some stronger regulations against the farming community. And again, much like the clean water thing, we want to see clean water too. We want to see bees as well. And the bee colony killing thing, it's a big problem, and pesticides are maybe a part of it. I've looked at studies that have said it's not a part of it. And the EPA study says it's not a lethal killer of bees. And more research is needed, I think. University, that's why I like the part about the university doing some research onto this. And farming practices are improving. John Deere has some kind of a biofilter they're working on to really get nearly all that dust from flying around onto the planter. And I would rather go down that approach today than this. And I agree, this is a compromise. It's a start to a compromise. But at this time, I would encourage a no vote on this amendment.
Okay. Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To Chair Anderson's point on the research, we're having discussions right now in ag finance. This is just in office level, so there isn't a bill written right now, but it addresses this exact issue that we're talking about with the University of Minnesota and some of the key stakeholders, not only in honeybee, but also wild bee or what you know, native bees, but in any case, doing research to find exactly what's what, and we're looking at actually moving that forward with some work. So it isn't complete enough, but to the point that we do need to have research and things like that, you are going to be seeing that in the other committee soon, I believe.
Representative Bly.
Thank you, Chair. And I'm troubled here because I prefer the original language myself, and I think you probably would have guessed that. I recognize this does put you in a difficult spot, Chair Anderson, and I also respect that farmers who use the treated seeds, it's a tool that they use, and it helps them accomplish their goals. It's something, though, that I've gotten more emails from my constituents asking me to reinstate the language that was originally there, people who are really concerned about pollinators and fear that not addressing it, not doing something to address it, will mean that we don't have any bees or pollinators. So, and I want to be respectful of the point of view that you have and the concern that you have that it may not necessarily fall into pesticides. And what we're seeing, I think, is disagreement between farmers. I mean, I hope it's not like the sheep and the cattle farmers of years ago, where they really fought hard against each other. But I think the passions are there, that there's a difference of opinion here. And what I liked about the original language is I think that it does take a deeper dive into what are the problems and what are the solutions. And if it is something that should be classified as a pesticide, that, and I understand that does open up other problems, but I think there are farmers who feel very strongly that it needs to be drawn into some kind of deeper study, and if regulation is required, we might need to look at that. So I'm troubled because I'm hearing the compromise, but it's not satisfying to the constituents that have written to me, and I guess I just offer that as another point of view, another perspective, that it is a difficult issue.
Yeah.
Chair Anderson, any other comments?
I guess I would just add one other thing. I have a copy of the executive order that the governor released, Executive Order 16-07. And on page 2, it talks about what he has directed the Department of Ag to do as of, you know, currently. And one of them is continue to develop and promote best management practices designed to protect and enhance pollinator health in Minnesota. And I thought that would have been a way for the department to start doing this now. But I talked to Assistant Commissioner Lohman after the meeting this morning, and he said that, in his mind, that they don't have that authority yet because, it deals with the seed treatment. But so that I thought that would be a way that they could, you know, start working on the BMPs under this. But I guess we have to wait and see about that, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question perhaps for Mr. Sullivan. So if you don't have the description of treated seed, then you really can't have any of the rest of the language. Is that correct? Can you talk about treated seed without having a definition for treated seed?
Mr. Sullivan.
Mr. Chair and Representative Poppy, yes, the term could be used in the statute without a definition, but the definition would provide more guidance to the Department of Agriculture and others about what the legislature means by the term treated seed.
Follow-up, Representative? No? Okay. Any other discussion? Representative Lai.
I guess I would like to hear what the department's, if you would weigh in on what your thoughts are about it.
Please state your name for the record.
Good evening. I'm Matt Wallman. I serve as Deputy Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. Just a point of clarification, from the executive order. The Department of Agriculture has statutory authority for pesticides, and the neonicotinoid review and the governor's executive order with regard to BMPs is applicable to foliar applications, but we do not have statutory authority for seed treatment, and so therefore we would not be able to develop BMPs around seed treatment. As you know, the governor had put forward the language that was originally in the bill and then was taken out of the bill. That is our preference, I think, in terms of the language that we would like to see move forward. Representative Clark's Johnson's bill is a reasonable path forward. We would support that. I think it's important that we get started immediately. I think the science is clear. The special registration review that we did, we spent almost two and a half years looking at 300 peer-reviewed scientific articles that are applicable to Minnesota regarding pollinator health and so forth. And so I think it's important to note that during the special registration review, we found that the science is not conclusive in terms of how we address some of these issues, and there's significant gaps. And I think that's what Representative Johnson his amendment is trying to move towards, is continuing to have that understanding and to develop that understanding of those BMPs. So that would be my comment, Mr. Chair.
Chair Anderson, go ahead.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I was just thinking, as the Assistant Commissioner was talking, that they spent a couple of years doing this in-depth study on neonicotinoids, but yet they aren't allowed by law to put together on paper BMPs. I just have to wonder how they could study something for 2 years, but yet they can't put together any kind of a practical suggestion on that very product that you studied for 2 years. Why can't you, I guess?
Mr. Rubin?
Mr. Chair, we did a special registration review. So the registration of the product that we have is a foliar product. And so we did a study of that product. Now, when we looked at the special registration review, we can come up with some guidance for producers on how to prevent pollinator or how to enhance pollinator health, and that's what we did. And one of the areas that we addressed in there was where some of the gaps are in the science. And some of the gaps include the seeded or treated seed is not addressed in our statute, and the DMTs are not addressed for treated seed. And so, you know, the executive order took action on areas where we have statutory authority. The areas that where we do not have statutory authority, particularly around seed treatments, and then we also, the governor also suggested that we establish a pollinator protection account which would fund some of those activities.
Chair Anderson, any other comments?
Mr. Chair, no, not really. Again, just a little bit puzzled by, you know, the governor could establish two committees, an interagency pollinator protection team and the Committee on Pollinator Protection. He could do that with an executive order, but yet he couldn't, or this order wouldn't allow any studies on BMPs. Just strikes me as a little bit narrow in that what they can do and can't do. That's just my opinion.
Mr. Wellman?
Mr. Chair, members, I remember a couple of years ago the legislature directed us to develop BMPs for bees, which we did. But they're foliar applications. There's nowhere in the statute that we provide, that the legislature provides us jurisdiction or authority for seed treatments. And so, you know, I understand your concern, but we do have, where we've been able to develop BMPs, we have, and where we do not have authority, we can't do it.
Representative Bly.
Thank you, Chair. And Mr. Wilma, I'm wondering, coming at this from the other side, does the compromise language restrict you in any way in looking, I mean, it's just the kind of restrictions that you're talking about now, not having the authority. But are there things that may be important to look at or may be important to go forward on that are not included in this compromise that might have been in the original language that, although I know they cause heartburn to the other farmers, it's, I'm asking, I guess, can you lay out for us how does this make it harder for you to get to where we'd like to see it be?
Mr. Ullman.
Well, Mr. Chair, members, the original language included the opportunity to take action where we saw problems, and so now we, you know, while this language allows us to develop the best management practices, it would not allow us to take enforcement action if we found, you know, problems with seed treatments.
Representative Blake.
What types of follow-up actions might there be? I mean, I guess one thing that I've heard is to say the desire to have someone show a need for the treated seed or something like that. Is that the kind of thing that you mean, that you would begin to look at those issues?
Mr.
Wilson, I'm sorry, can you rephrase that question? I didn't hear all of it.
I'm sorry. Yeah. So what I'm wondering is, I'm asking you about how it restricts you, and you mentioned it would restrict you from taking regulatory kind of action. And I'm wondering what kind of action that might that be. And one of the examples that I've heard is that you might ask that there be a showing of the need for that kind of treatment on a seed before it. I think what we heard testimony on was that sometimes the treatments are insurance policies. They're like, there may or may not be a problem, but we're going to make sure that there is no problem by putting these treatments on. Is that something that you would consider or that you'd be looking at, or are there other things that might, I mean, I'm asking you to speculate about an unknown, I realize that, but I'm trying to get a little more clarity.
Mr. Fullman.
Mr. Chair, we haven't fully developed that yet, but you know, I think your example of you know, a verification of need is one that we would certainly take a strong look at. And I think it's important that, you know, when we look at foliar applications, for example, I think a lot of farmers are following those thresholds. So you look at, you know, what is the threshold for which you would spray for aphids? You know, I think there's, you know, generally accepted numbers around that before you would make an application. And most farmers, I would say, follow that pretty closely. And so it's really not about, you know, creating a whole bunch of new work, but it's about, you know, following the label.
Mm-hmm. Chair Anderson, I'm sorry, follow-up representative.
I recognize that, again, this is a tool that farmers are using successfully, and it's something that they count on. And, you know, in many ways it replaced perhaps even more dangerous problems before, and I recognize that. I guess I'm asking to just sort of get a sense of what's out there. But I too would like to see some common ground so that there could be a way for farmers who feel threatened by the use of these treated seeds in some fashion, and those who feel that they really need them. It would be great if we could find a way to explore what the options are, what the problems are, and come to a way where there wasn't this fear of harm on either side.
Do you have any comments there, Mr. Lennon? If not, because, okay, we have two on the list. Chair Anderson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll cut right to the chase here. When the term verification of need was brought up, and I think the farmers are very concerned about how do you verify a need for a seed treatment, which is what we're talking about here. When you buy your seed, maybe in December or January, when you plant it in April and May, you have no idea if you can meet this, whatever this verification of need is. And I think when this came out again, back in the executive order, it raised such a flag of concern as to what that actually meant and what that was going to do to require whatever verification of need was, and especially as it pertains to seed. To me, it just doesn't work because when you need it is probably 6 months after you would make an order to buy it or use it.
I'm Representative Ruick.
I'm really, really puzzled on where the Department of Agriculture is coming from. Really, really puzzled. And the reason I'm puzzled that if you're applying a herbicide or pesticide, I don't think it matters. If you put a bag or a 5 gallon bucket in the back of a wagon and you go across the field and it's spilled, you got a problem, right? It has nothing to do with whether or not you were trying to protect pollinators or anything else. And so it just, I explain to me again that if we have something that we know, it's a neonic, and completely independent of the fact of where it starts out, it happens to be stuck on a seed, and so now you've got it in a powder form, that somehow you folks can't go look into that. It just boggles my mind. That it's got, you know, we're focused on we're not asking you to figure out, you know, all the ins and outs of seeded tree, you know, you're treating the seed. We're talking about a situation where you've got a foliant, forget about how it got there, that is alleged to be damaging the pollinators. And so you're telling me that the governor has explicitly explained to you guys, your folks, you can't go out there and look at that. Even look at best management practices to make sure that if there's a way to prevent that foliant that apparently takes place, it could damage the bees. I mean, what is all this business about? I mean, it looks like you're going down the wrong rabbit hole here when you don't even need to. So, I mean, I look at this as, I mean, in another world, the Department of Defense, we would call this is a bunch of bureaucratic stuff. You just kind of slide it over here. If you want more money, ask for it. If that's the issue, you don't feel you have the FTEs, you don't have the resources to try to figure out how this foliant is going. Now, so I guess one, you need more money. And are you truly worried about, are you trying to go after figuring out how to outsmart the seed treatment business, or are you looking at that basic thing that I think we all agree on, that there's a problem, the dust is out there, and maybe then maybe some more money, and what is it that you can't and can look at? I'm really puzzled. I mean, why are we even discussing, you can't do this as an agency?
Representative, is that a question or a comment?
Well, two. You need more money, to look at something that I think there's no disagreement, starting as I understood the governor's direction last summer. And it's not about go investigate the seed treatment, it's about how to prevent the dust from damaging the bees. I mean, I'm just getting down to a pretty basic level here. You need more money to do that? And are you saying that you're absolutely forbid by state statute you can't go out and do that based on that broad direction the governor gave your agency?
Well, Mr. Roman, Mr. Chair, members, the governor provided some direction to the state agencies in his executive order for areas that the department has authority. We don't make the laws, the legislature does. And we do not have statutory authority for seed treatment. To the question, Representative, do we need more money? We, you know, there were two items here. There was the governor's language that was in the original bill, and then there was a request for $1.5 million in a pollinator protection account. Part of that is in general fund, and part of that is a dedicated fee request. To work with the University of Minnesota to develop the best management practices. Now, the best management practices take time to develop. They also require, you know, significant scientific review. And frankly, there has not been a lot of research and review around seed treatments, and that's what we're talking about here.
Representative, okay.
It's just clear we're talking investigating seed treatment, and we should be looking at a dust that's a byproduct of putting seed in the ground. And I just, you know, doesn't make sense to me that we're prohibited from looking at that. You know, put something in the statute that tries to send us down rabbit hole, as far as I'm concerned at this point, because we're going right over some pretty basic stuff here.
Representative Johnson, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just want to bring this back to what we're doing here. Let's talk about this amendment. This amendment is a modest approach, obviously a compromise between the DE amendment and the original bill. It's not about verification of need. It's about defining treated seeds so that The commissioner, we can establish that the commissioner is responsible for developing guidance and best management practices for treated seed. That's commonly done and appropriate in this instance. It's also about engaging the University of Minnesota and others in conducting research and demonstration projects and developing recommended best management practices, and then adds treated seed to the education and training. Let's go back 2 days. And we saw testifier after testifier make a very compelling case. In fact, my notes from that day, held on to them, and I think I can still read them. All the testifiers stressed the need to know more. And the need to do and the need to address that, and we heard it across the board. The governor initiated this discussion last August, I believe it was, and proposed in the bill a more assertive approach. But this, my purpose here is, in my opinion, a compromise. When I am at home, my neighbors keep telling me compromise, and so when I saw those two issues and the two approaches, I thought this was a legitimate compromise, and it's a very modest approach, and so it's a pretty at a basic level, and so therefore I ask for your support for the amendment.
Thank you, Representative Mahoney. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I hate to speak after the author of the amendment gave his speech, but just to Representative Lewick's comments about why the department didn't move forward. Having sat through probably too many committee hearings in my day and watched a chair absolutely destroy somebody who works for the state government because they did something just a little bit that wasn't authorized in law, I'll go along with the department on that one. You got to cover yourself and not get fired.
Okay, members, let's go with a roll call vote. One final comment, Chair, and then we'll go through to the roll call vote, members.
Mr. Chair, members, again, I appreciate the offer to compromise, and I agree it is an offer to compromise. But at this time, I would recommend a no vote, but I'd be willing, again, to visit with the representative to look again at that definition, if that's the right place for it, and then also to find out if this would need a fiscal note. We haven't discussed that yet either. So at this time, I'd recommend a no vote, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Mr. Webster, go ahead with the roll call vote.
Anderson?
No.
Backer?
No.
Bennett?
No.
Y?
Yes.
Daniels?
No.
Johnson?
Yes.
Kunesh Bodine?
Yes.
Lewick?
No.
Mahoney?
Aye.
Mariani? Miller?
No.
Norris?
No.
Pearson?
No.
Poppy?
Yes.
Poston?
No.
Sauk?
We have 5 ayes for the Amendment A3 and 9 noes. The motion does not prevail and the amendment is not adopted. Okay, Representative Bly has an A2 amendment. Representative Bly, would you like to move your amendment?
Yes, I would. I have a pretty good idea of how the vote is going to go, but I will ask for a roll call vote. And as I said earlier, this is one of the issues that I've gotten the most emails or the most comments from my constituents that they would like to see this language restated, and that's why I'm bringing the amendment.
Representative Bly moves the A2 amendment. Further discussion to this amendment?
Chair Anderson. Thanks, Mr. Chair. We pretty much covered the topic. Again, I'm open to some compromise, but again, on this amendment, I would encourage a no vote.
Any other further discussions? Okay, seeing none, are you ready there, Mr. Webster, for a roll call?
Yes.
Okay, go ahead, Mr. Webster.
Anderson?
No.
Backer?
No.
Bennett?
No.
Why?
Yes.
Daniels?
No.
Johnson?
No.
Kunesh Bodine?
Yes.
Lewick?
No.
Mahoney?
Aye.
Mariani? Miller?
No.
Norris?
No.
Pearson?
No.
Poppy?
No.
Poston?
No.
Sauk?
Roll call is three yeses and 11 nays. The motion does not prevail, and the amendment is not adopted of the A2. Okay, is there any further discussion to House File 1717 as amended? Chair Anderson, do you have any final comment? Representative Johnson, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just want to, two remarks for Representative Anderson. First of all, thank you for the gentlemanly debate tonight on the amendment. But I think I said this 2 years ago when I said, thank you for the opportunity, the way you present the policy bill. You did it 2 years ago, you did it today, in that you do it on a Tuesday. We're thorough in our approach to the policy bill, getting to hear about it. And I benefit from sleeping on things. I really do. And there's not always the tradition in every committee that we get that chance to reflect on what we've heard, reflect on the testimony, reflect on the bill, talk to people about it. And you gave us that opportunity. And may that be a model for all committees in the Minnesota House of Representatives. And I do deeply appreciate that. Thank you very much.
Chair Anderson?
Well, treat you on me next time. Go ahead.
Pizza, huh?
That's on the
tape.
to that question or comment, I have to say thanks to our CA, Mark Knisley, and my COA, Tyler Webster. As we all know, these last couple of weeks have been pretty hectic and pretty busy. And I know sometimes, Mark, when schedules change and it's a moving target, it's hard to keep things in order. But he has done a really good job of scheduling this and giving plenty of time for amendments and such. And so I'd like to say thanks to you, our staff people, and Ken and Colby, too, for doing a great job with what you guys do behind the scenes to keep this going. Mr. Chair, thank you all for the polite discussion, and again, still willing to visit on this. But I would renew my motion that House File 1717, as amended, be re-referred to the General Register.
Chair Anderson renews his motion that House File 1717, as amended, be referred to the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed say nay. The motion prevails. And members, we do appreciate, I appreciate working with everybody here. It's been a good debate today and a good committee to serve. And with that, there will be one more meeting next Wednesday. And then, and that will be our final, Chair Anderson?
It's going to be kind of sad to have this committee stop meeting, but there has been a request for later on after deadlines are passed to have a meeting and discuss some of the challenges that agribusiness faces with regulations from MPCA. So we may look at that if we can schedule it and have time to look at that. It would be just informational, but that may be on the schedule many weeks down the road. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, I think that would be very important with agriculture making roughly 26% of our economy here in Minnesota. So with that said, we are adjourned. Thank you, members. Have a good week.